Secretary DHS Secretary Nielsen, who was accosted at a Mexican restaurant by protesters and heckled. We've seen other incidents of this. We'll talk to Carl about all that and what it means for the future of our country. And lastly, we'll talk about the passing of Charles Krauthammer, one of the great intellectual minds of our time. We knew it was coming, but it happened this week, and it was sad nonetheless. So a lot to get to, and let's jump right in. We've got Steve Cortez on the phone. Steve is a contributor to Real Clear Politics, contributor to CNN, former Trump campaign official. Steve, thank you for joining me. Appreciate your time.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, Steve. So, look, I saw you were on CNN all this week, defending the president's policy here. Give us a sense of this. I mean, the reaction among folks in the media and certainly the Democrats has been nothing short of apocalyptic on this policy. And look, I think the administration didn't do itself any favors from a messaging standpoint, a sort of compassion standpoint. But the story has moved from where it was. You know, Trump came out, said that they were going to fix it. Issued this executive order. Melania went to the board. So, I mean, where does this whole thing stand as you see it sitting here right now on this Sunday night?
Right. Well, and listen, I'll be the first to admit to you, I think there's more questions than answers right now, even from Team Trump. The executive order to me was confusing. I personally didn't like it because I actually think he was starting to win the argument in the public sphere, in the public square. And what I mean by win the argument, by the way, doesn't mean that any of us want kids to be in this condition. We don't, obviously. I mean, as human beings, as Americans, you know, as a father myself, I anguish for these kids and the position they're in. I also believe that the reason these kids have been put in that position isn't President Trump, isn't Border Patrol, isn't ICE, isn't our laws. It's the fact that their parents, or in some cases, a guardians, because we're not even sure they're the parents, but the adults who are with them decided, unfortunately, to make a terrible choice, which is to cross our border illegally and criminally trespass and break and enter into our country. And when you do that, when you break and enter into a home in Chicago, if you happen to have your children in tow, you're going to be separated from your children. You're going to cause anguish for them. And that's awful. But it's not the fault of the cop who arrested you. It's your fault. And I would say the same thing about these people. And there's been so much conflating also in mainstream media of people who have legitimate asylum claims. I happen to think those are relatively few, but there are some, surely. Those who have legitimate asylum claims, there's a method for that, which is go to the checkpoints, which are the ports of entry, legal points of entry. Raise your hand, say, I'm here for asylum. Here's why. You will not be separated from your parents. But if you decide on your own and on your own volition to willfully trespass, criminally trespass in our country, President Trump has been unambiguous since he was a candidate. You will be arrested for that. And if you're arrested for a crime, you get separated from your children. And it stinks for the kids. And I feel terribly for them. But we didn't make them the victims. The adults did.
You know, Stephen, we've talked about this. You know President Trump. You've spent a lot of time with him. You've seen him on the campaign trail. There is nothing that he hates more than to show weakness and to have to walk things back, like right. on his, travel ban, which he initiated when he first came into office. Clearly, he wouldn't do it unless he was under tremendous political pressure. And it sounds sure. like from the reporting that, look, he was getting an earful from Ivanka and Melania about this as well. And he decided to issue this executive order. That to me signaled that he knew he sort of felt like the issue was getting away from him publicly from a PR perspective. But as soon as he did that, he turned around and sort of doubled down. He was tweeting this morning about, look, grabbing people and sending them back before they even have a hearing this morning. So he's kind of been, maybe a tactical retreat and then doubled down. I mean, what's the strategy here in moving forward from the Trump administration?
Right. And Tom, listen, I'll be the first to admit, I think the administration, the president himself, they've been a bit confusing this week. And I don't like that. I like clarity. I don't like separating families, but I do like zero tolerance. And I think it sends the right message. I think it's the right deterrence policy long term. I love immigration. I'm the son of an immigrant. So is the president. I'm an Hispanic. I feel I think it's an incredible gift to this country. I think illegal immigration, by the way, is an affront to legal immigrants, most of all. But in terms of this crisis, I think I'll be the first to say, yeah, I think poorly handled. I think mixed signals. I would much rather see the president be resolute, because, and here's one reason I say that too, not only because I believe it on principle, but when he gave, I think he signaled to his opposition that if you call me Hitler 5,000 times, you know, which is what the media did this week, I might give a little bit. I might concede on some points. And guess what? He got no credit for that anyway. They attacked him all the more. I mean, the day he issued the executive order and said, okay, we're not going to separate families, he got attacked as vociferously, if not more so, than he was previous to issuing the executive order. So if you're not going to win sort of PR points anyway, I'd rather he just fight on principle. And to me, the principle is, which he was, again, just unambiguous about in 2016, maybe the foundational reason he was elected, was that we are going to build a wall, we're going to get serious about illegal immigration, we're going to get serious about having a border and having a country. And to me, equivocating is not the right message. And I'll be the first to admit, they did equivocate a few times. Now, he seems to be coming much more around to, I don't want to say to my position, because I don't want to make it seem like the president is, you know, is listening to me only and coming to my position. But I've stayed pretty consistent. I think he wavered a bit. I think he's coming back to more of what I guess I would call his 2016 position now in the last couple of days, given his tweets.
But do you think, just given the way this has played out, Steve, I mean, I understand your point. He gives a little bit. He doesn't get any credit for it. But the one thing that did do is once he said, listen, we're not going to separate these families. I'm going to, you know, we're going to keep the kids and parents together. The Democrats immediately said, well, to your point, they still attacked him and said, well, that's not even the issue. Now you're just caging families and this is horrible. And it did sort of bring to light the fact that the Democrats are probably most likely overplaying their hand now, because they did see political advantage here, are overplaying their hands. And effectively, some of them are arguing for open borders. We had Cynthia Nixon, who's running for governor of New York, who called ICE a terrorist organization. You had Kamala Harris on TV today saying that we should critically reexamine ICE's mission, how it's being administered, and potentially, quote, start from scratch. So do you think, because the president gave a little bit, that was enough to have the Democrats overplay their hand, and now President Trump actually might have the political upper hand once again, given that the Democrats have kind of gone so far to the left on this?
You know, interesting, Tom, and you might have a point there. Listen, sometimes when I think, even as a Trump supporter, sometimes, you know, when I think he's a little nuts, there's method to the madness, and perhaps that's what he was doing. And if he was, then he's, you know, beyond my level of critical thinking. And he was thinking,
I'm not even saying it was. I'm not even suggesting it was. He was playing chess, and he was two moves ahead. I'm just saying it's just a, you know, this happens all the time when one party sees political advantage, they press it and press it and press it to the point where they overplay it, and then it becomes the tables get turned immediately back.
No, and that could be. And you're so right too. By the way, so. I think the Democrats did two things that were very harmful, or not just Democrats, but Trump's critics did two things that were very harmful this week. One was exactly right, overplaying their hand in terms of criticizing ICE, making ICE into, you know, the bad guys. By the way, ICE is the most Hispanic agency of the federal government. You know, I think that's an important point, first of all. These men and women do hard work. These are brave people who take a lot of risk, who sometimes die literally to protect us. And to assail them, I think, is a terrible, number one, just a terrible thing ethically, but also terrible politics. But then number two, you're right. They took it so far, the constant comparison to Nazis, for example. And I don't mean by wackos on social media. We sort of expect that. But I mean Donny Deutsch on MSNBC. And I mean, most of all, Michael Hayden, former head of the CIA, a four-star general, who tweeted out a picture of Auschwitz and compared what we're doing. Listen, even if you don't agree with this policy, to compare it to Auschwitz is the most obscene and extreme and illogical reach that I could possibly think of. So I think you're right. In some ways, they overplayed their hand, you know, dramatically so. And my guess is, we'll see, you know, only time will tell, but my guess is the people see through that. They say, you know, it's not being a Nazi saying you can't cross our border illegally. That's a big, big difference from what the Nazis did. ICE is not the SS, and ICE should not be abolished, you know, despite what Hollywood people might say, including Cynthia Nixon. So, and listen, and maybe Trump, whether meaningfully or not, intentionally or not, he might have unveiled some of that through his concession or slight concession of the executive order. That's a good point.
one last question, exit question quickly before I let you go. You know, the speed with which things move these days, particularly in the news business, I mean, Kim Jong-un, the summit with Kim Jong-un is like less than 2 weeks old, and it feels like it was 40 years ago. Is immigration, is this going to be in the rearview mirror next week, week after, or is immigration an issue that's going to stick around because Trump wants to push it to gin up his base for November, and Democrats do as well, and so this issue is not going away?
My quick answer is this is going to continue to be an issue because I fear we're going to end up with somewhat of refugee camps, almost like they have in Europe. I hope I'm wrong. I think that's bad for America. But if we do have that, and I think we're going to, in June, July, August, this is going to be an issue in the midterms.
All right, we got to leave it there. Steve Cortez, contributor to Real Clear Politics and CNN former Trump campaign official. Steve, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks.
We'll talk to you soon. Okay, we are going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk to David Beiler from the Weekly Standard about the battle for the Senate in 2018. He's got a new model out with percentages and all the bells and whistles. Stick around. We'll talk to him about it right after these words. Welcome back, Chicago. I'm Tom Bevin, co-founder, president of Real Clear Politics. I'm joined on the phone now by David Beiler, who is a political analyst for the Weekly Standard, formerly with Real Clear Politics. David, good to have you back on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So listen, I wanted to have you on to talk about this 2018 Senate model that you unveiled this week at the Weekly Standard, weeklystandard.com, where you now are updating this thing regularly, projecting, who's going to win the battle for the Senate. Give our listeners a sense of your initial projections as you just started out and made this thing live this week.
Yeah, so the model is called Swing Seat. It lives on the site. Like you said, I update it daily with all the new polls that it needs to sort of get probabilities for candidates in each of these races and for both parties, which party is going to have control of the Senate as of January 2019. So right now, it projects that Republicans have a roughly 70% chance of holding on to the Senate, and Democrats have about a 30% chance of taking over. And it's best guess, now there are wide error margins on this, obviously, but it's best guess at the actual outcome is that Republicans end the election with 51 seats in the Senate.
Which is where they are right now.
Right, exactly. And
so it's a wash.
Exactly. And, you know, in some of those situations, maybe the Republicans, you know, and the Democrats win all their seats. But really what usually happens is the Democrats flip one or two seats that Republicans currently hold, and Republicans usually flip one or two seats that Democrats hold right now. So you have all these different, you know, Democrats in deep red territory. The model thinks that Republicans are going to be able to usually take one or two of those, but often lose a state like Nevada or Arizona that Republicans currently hold, but maybe is a little bit purple or trending towards purple or something like that.
Do you have, David, does your model indicate which seats are most likely to flip? I mean, if you look at your simulations, which seat on the Republican side is most likely turns over or is flipped most often? Is it Indiana? Is it West Virginia? Or do you not go into that kind of detail?
Yeah, so I do have state-by-state readings for and probabilities for every state. Right now, the polling is pretty sparse. So I'm very confident about the top line. I think that it's the right picture of where the election is. In some cases, these probabilities that are in the individual states are based on one or two polls. So, you know, take those with a grain of salt. But right now, the model is pretty high on, compared to other states, I should say, is high on Republican chances in Indiana and North Dakota. That's because you've had recent polling that put Kevin Cramer, the North Dakota Republican, up by four, and you have basically a tied race, very, very narrow lead, if I remember correctly, in the last poll in Indiana. And on the sort of flip side, the model thinks that Democrats have a really pretty good chance of flipping Arizona. If you look at the polling there, a lot of them have shown Kristen Sinema leading against, well, all the various Republicans that are currently competing to go up against her. Democrats have kind of a narrower edge in Nevada. The incumbent Senator Dean Heller is running there, and he's kind of right now polling better than you might expect a Republican senator in a purple state in a very Democratic year to poll. So that's about the size of some of the individual races. And there's a couple other close ones. Missouri, Tennessee, Florida are all really close at this point.
So, you know, we did have polling come out this week showing, for example, Tammy Baldwin in pretty good shape in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But Florida was, you know, and Manchin up to, I think, seven or so in West Virginia is in pretty good shape, according to the latest polls. But Florida seems to be one that's really, I think, more vulnerable than some thought it would be. That race looks to be pretty darn tight.
Yeah, so right now, according to the model, Bill Nelson has about a 58% chance of winning in Florida. And, you know, things that have a 42% chance happen all the time. Good model said Trump had a much less than 42% chance of winning the presidency. He ended up winning the presidency. So that's a toss-up race. And when you look, so in the model, I have two sort of calculations that I run. One's a poll-based calculation, and one's a fundamentals-based calculation. And the fundamentals calculation just says, okay, knowing what we know about, you know, Trump's approval rating, about how the state voted in the last presidential election, sort of everything you would think of aside from those head-to-head matchups, it kind of figures out where we would project the race. And the interesting thing about Florida is that the model thinks that kind of based on fundamentals alone, Nelson should be doing better than he currently is. The race is a lot closer than you'd expect, sort of based on that, if that kind of difference between those calculations makes sense.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with David Byler, who's a political analyst, data analyst for the Weekly Standard, as I mentioned at the top, or formerly with Real Clear Politics. So, David, go back to the sort of, you said it's a 70% chance that Republicans are going to hold, and the model's best guess is that it'll end up 51-49, basically a wash from where it is right now. But talk to me about the, you know, the best case scenario for Democrats, best case scenario for Republicans. We've heard people saying, you know, Newt Gingrich and others saying, oh, well, this is going to be a red wave happening, red dawn, whatever you want to call it. And look, the Senate map, we know, is historically bad for the Democrats. So what's the best outcome Republicans might be able to, does the model show, might be possible for Republicans and the same for the Democrats?
Right, right. So on the Republican side, the model thinks that at this point, when we're this far out, it's still possible for the Republicans to have maybe 55 seats. In some cases, it has, you know, more because the model has long tails. But without getting into the technical details, basically, the model thinks that a lot of these red state, you know, Democratic senators could lose. And that if you had sort of the polls moving towards Republicans, a few points in each of these states, then you could get a net gain of 2-3 seats for the Republicans. That's kind of their best case scenario where, you know, West Virginia, North Dakota, Missouri, and, a few of these other seats vote kind of like they did in 2016. And that would allow Republicans to make some gains, excuse me, or I guess more similar to 2016, not exactly the same way, but that allow Republicans to make some gains, even if the environment is good enough for Democrats to take back the House. On the Democratic side, they have a little bit of a ceiling. You can imagine scenarios where they get to, where they get to a majority or they get to 48 or maybe 47 seats. But there's kind of a lid on the number of gains that they make. In most of the model simulations, Democrats, you know, win Arizona. In most of the model simulations, they win Nevada. They have kind of an outside shot at Texas. Right now, the model puts them at 80-20. So Cruz is a clear favorite, but, you know, 20% isn't nothing. So really what you have is a situation where the map gives Republicans a really pretty high ceiling. It gives Democrats a possibility of gaining control. But, you know, they can only make so many gains before they start running into states like Texas or Mississippi or Nebraska or Utah, where
what about,
it's just hard for them to win no matter what.
One race that you did not mention where, Democrats have said, look, we have a shot, is Tennessee. Marsha Blackburn there versus Phil Bredesen, former governor. What is the What does the model say about Democrats' chances there?
The model gives a slight edge to Bredesen right now because he's been polling so well. But this is another case like Florida where the fundamentals disagree some with the current polling. So, like you said, Democrats do have a shot at this seat. They're doing well in the polling. They have about the best candidate that I think they could possibly get in the state of Tennessee in Phil Bredesen. And it's a blue year, which, you know, does matter that currently public opinion is favoring the Democrats. But, you know, Tennessee is a really red state. And if you just, you know, kind of take blinders to the head-to-head polls and guess who's going to win an open seat in Tennessee, your guess should be the Republicans almost all the time, if that makes sense.
Yep. All right, we've got to leave it there. David Byler, data analyst for the Weekly Standard, thanks for joining me. We'll check back with you in a few weeks and see where this swing state model stands. David, thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, we are going to take a quick break. When we get back, Adele Malpass with Real Clear Politics will join us to talk about the Democrats' messaging on the economy and a couple of these primaries that are up to on Tuesday. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Listen to Tom Bevin when it's convenient for you. Look for the Tom Bevin podcasts on iTunes and the podcast page of WLSAM.com.
And we are back. Tom Bevin with you, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics. I'm joined on the phone now by Adele Malpass, who's our national political correspondent. Adele, thanks for joining me tonight. Appreciate your time.
Tom, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
All right, so Adele, let's talk. We just talked about the battle for the Senate, and I wanted to talk to you. You've got a piece that'll be appearing on Real Clear Politics this week talking about the Democrats and the challenges they face this November on their messaging on the economy. Give our listeners a preview of your article that will appear on realclearpolitics.com.
The Democrats have been talking about their blue wave, and one of their, it's, you know, really starting to look a little like a trickle. And part of it is they can't get any traction on an economic message. There's the far left progressive, you know, they're all taking a playbook, you know, page out of the Bernie Sanders playbook, and it's free college tuition, free Medicare, free, you know, job guarantee, It might work in a Democratic primary, but it's not working as a general election message. And so the more moderate message is that wages are not going up as fast as some consumer goods, like healthcare, prescription drugs, gasoline. And that moderate message is a little more believable in its own way, but the problem is in a really strong economy, and economics are often the top issue for voters. It is a, you know, hard sell with a pretty with growing GDP and 18-year low unemployment.
Yeah, you know, I've talked about this before. The economy is going to be a double-edged sword for Republicans in the sense that the better it is, the more voters feel good about things and maybe turn their attention to other issues like healthcare and education, issues that Democrats have advantages on. But obviously, Democrats have their own needle to thread, right? Which is to say, they can't ignore how good the economy is, but they still, and they can't, I don't think it's credible to argue that it's a disaster, but they do need to have some sort of messaging in there that appeals to voters in some way to say, look, despite the fact that the economy is doing okay or you know, doing better than it was, it's still not great. As you mentioned, wages are an issue. They can point to income inequality. I'm just not sure whether that's going to be enough to turn the tables for them in November.
I think the economic insecurity below the surface is kind of their message, and I think it is you know, plausible for some, but I think much of this election is really a referendum on Donald Trump, and I think his promises made, promises kept with his long list of accomplishments is going to be very persuasive. We know that the final in October, we always are talking about the independent, moderate voter who is less partisan, less plugged in, and they really like results. That's a group that looks at what have you done, what are you accomplished, what are you going to do for me in the next 2 years? And I do think the Democrats' economic message kind of falls apart a bit. We're only 6 months into the tax cuts, and you can already see the benefits of you know, what happens when you have an environment of less taxes and less regulation.
We're speaking with Adele Malpass. She's a national political correspondent for Real Clear Politics. Adele, there are some primaries on Tuesday, including your, I guess, former home state, maybe of New York. Talk to us a little bit about those races. In particular, you know, people have been focused a little bit on this governor's race and the challenge Cynthia Nixon is challenging Andrew Cuomo. Now, Cynthia Nixon said something over the weekend saying that ICE was, you know, a terrorist organization, which struck me as way, way over the top. Certainly as a general election message. But does she have any legitimate chance at knocking off Cuomo, or is this just more of a vanity run for her?
Andrew Cuomo's on his third run. Third terms are often very tricky. You have a long track record to defend, and she is a celebrity candidate. She is progressive. She's far left, and he is ironic as blue states start to become even further left. He's now presented as a moderate, and one of the other things that has occurred in the last few days is the former Democratic mayor of Syracuse, Stephanie Miner, who was also head of the New York State Democratic Party, has decided to run as an independent, and she has already has endorsements of quite a few leading Democrats, and he now is going to have a challenger on his right and his left. Now he in the general election. He will absolutely be faced with this independent Democrat. And in 2014, Andrew Cuomo had a Democratic challenger, again, Zephyr Teachout. She was a very far left progressive, and she had no money, and she got 40% of the vote in a Democratic primary. And so I don't think you can rule out Cynthia Nixon, who is already kind of running a more credible race, more well financed. And you know, I think as the comments about ICE are kind of indicative of where the far left is, and the resist movement is very, very big in the five boroughs, and I think she will be developing a following. So I don't think Andrew Cuomo can fully ignore it. There have been multiple polls out that show him far ahead, but the September the governor's race is a September primary, and the primary on Tuesday is only for congressional candidates. And the race there is there are nine Republican congressional candidates, and all of them are in quite purple spots, and all of them have to really have competitive races. And part of the Democrats' plan is they are focused on really seven out of the nine in the hopes of flipping the House to the Democrats.
And one of those races that's been garnering a lot of attention is the race in Staten Island. Michael Grimm is back running for Congress. Give our listeners a sense of where that race stands. It seems like it's a total circus.
Yeah, it is a complete drama moment. And I will say everything with Michael Grimm is always kind of drama. But he was Staten Island is Trump country. It is he has an 85% approval rating among both Republican and Democratic voters. It is truly the where the Trump movement kind of voter is. And Michael Grimm was a former FBI agent and Marine, and he was the congressman from 2010 to 2014. Lots of drama there in his time in Congress, and he
famously said that he would throw a reporter off the balcony of the Capitol, if I recall.
Yes, exactly. He's done that. In 2010, his finance chair went to prison. He then proceeds in 2014 to get a 20-count indictment in September, but goes on to win and then is convicted of tax fraud, but still wins in November by 13 points. So he has a really massive following in Staten Island. And about a month ago, a poll came out in which he was ahead. The convicted criminal was ahead because he was running to the right of the current congressman, a guy named Dan Donovan, who was the Staten Island borough president as well as the Staten Island DA. And but since then, Trump has been tweeting and has fully endorsed Dan Donovan. And Dan has upped his game quite a bit with a lot of television and a lot of social media. And the president's endorsement has helped enough to the point of where the current poll has him 7 points ahead. So the race has flipped from Michael Grimm ahead to now Dan Donovan ahead. But and we've seen it all over the country when the president puts his weight behind a candidate. In West Virginia, we saw a convicted criminal there also running Blankenship in you know, he was ahead at one point and the president put his weight behind it and he did not win. And so I do think I think at this point, Dan looks like he's going to, you know, at the moment, he looks like he saved his situation. But Michael Grimm has a really big following and he is very well liked everywhere he goes. He did a lot of great things during Superstorm Sandy, which hits Staten Island hard. So it is a race to watch. And if the convicted criminal wins, the Democratic opponent there has $1.1 million on hand. So it's going to be a real race in the general election, too.
All right. We've got to leave it there. Adele Mountpass, national political correspondent for Real Clear Politics. Thanks for joining me tonight. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, Carl Cannon, our Washington Bureau Chief and Executive Editor, will talk about, Charles Krauthammer passed away this week. We also will talk to Carl about this new form of public harassment. You saw Sarah Sanders get denied service at a restaurant. We saw Secretary Nielsen, Homeland Security Secretary, publicly accosted by protesters in a Mexican restaurant last week. Pam Bondi, the attorney general down in Florida, was hounded by protesters after coming out of a movie theater. What's going on here? Is this the new normal in our public life? Stick around. We're going to be right back after these words. And we're back. Tom Bevin with you, co-founder, president of Brooklyn Politics, rolling into the final segment of the show here, and that means I've got my cleanup hitter, Carl Cannon, on the phone, Washington Bureau Chief Executive Editor. Mr. Cannon, how are you this evening?
I'm good, buddy. I'm good. It was a good weekend. How about you?
Well, I spent all day working today, sorting through the madness that is our political life. And part of that madness, Carl, concerned this story, which blew up this weekend, that Sarah Huckabee Sanders went to dinner with a group of friends. I guess there were maybe seven or eight of them total. And her friends were seated down at this small restaurant. I guess it's only 26 seat place in rural Virginia. And so the group seated, Sarah Sanders comes in. And the next thing you know, the owner of the restaurant gets a text from her manager or the chef saying, Sarah Sanders is just here. And, you know, the wait staff is anxious, doesn't know what to do. And so the owner drives over there and basically says, calls her out onto the patio and says, I'd like you to leave. And she politely got up and left, and as did the rest of her party. But to be refused service at a restaurant because someone disagrees with your political views, Carl, folks on the left are hailing this. They think that Trump supporters and Trump administration officials should be publicly shamed, to be held to account for representing this administration, which I think is immoral, unethical, etc. And folks on the right, and not just Trump supporters, but other folks are sort of aghast that this is the new normal, that this is now commonplace or becoming more commonplace. We've seen different examples of it with DHS Secretary Nielsen last week. She got, I think, heckled at a Mexican restaurant. Pam Biondi, the attorney general of Florida, was just heckled leaving a movie theater over the weekend as well. So, Carl, help me sort this out. What is going on here? What does this all mean? Is this the way it's going to be moving forward?
Well, you know, they've been doing this the whole time President Obama has been in office. You remember
President Trump?
Excuse me, President Trump has been in office. I was thinking of this. It was right after the transition. It was right after the inauguration, and Chuck Schumer's house was picketed by quote liberals end quote by people on the left because he had the temerity to vote for, I think, confirmed Jim Mattis as Secretary of Defense, and they threatened. Basically, it was a veiled threat, a not so veiled threat against Schumer. If you cooperate with the Republicans, we will run against you. We will picket you. We will make your life miserable. They've been doing this, by the way, in Alexandria, Virginia, to various officials, going to their houses now. This is sort of what Sinn Féin was to the armed provost in Northern Ireland. That's what these groups are to the Antifa movement. They don't actually do violence, but there's always there's a threat there. There's an implication of violence. We will, on a personal level, make your life miserable. And I'm afraid it will last if it works. And the way it won't work is if these people are rejected at the ballot box. And you hate to blame Democrats for this who aren't doing it, normal mainstream Democrats, but they haven't called these people out. And you know, all these Republican officials are supposed to call out Trump, but I don't know any Democratic officials have called this out. It's a low-grade form of terrorism, really.
Well, in fact, Carl, Maxine Waters, there's about a six-minute video of her over the weekend. She was at a rally to, you know, protest the separation of families thing at the border or whatever, and she went on about a six-minute stemwinder against Trump and actually encouraged her supporters to for more public harassment of Trump officials in the name of standing up to him and his administration, et cetera. So if anything, you have members of the Democratic Party, and again, Maxine Waters, she's not an insignificant backbencher. She's someone of some, you know, and she's been out there agitating to impeach Trump, but arguing that, yes, this is a good thing. We need more of it.
Well, she is a backbencher. She's not an obscure backbencher. But your point's, well, this is the point we're making here, is that Democratic elected officials are using the tactics of, you know, civil disobedience or the street. Some of them are quite, you know, uncivil. We haven't even gotten to the language these people use. Usually they're describing how crude they think Trump is, and they say things cruder than Trump's ever said in public life. So the hypocrisy is sort of, you don't quite know what to do with it. But you think about Virginia. So here's Lexington, Virginia, where Sarah Huckabee goes for a meal, in a state that Hillary Clinton carried, but narrowly. She got about 50% of the vote. Trump got about 45% of the vote. In Lexington, in that county, I'm sure Trump carried it. So what are they saying? What are the implications? How would they like it, let's just say, if it was done to Obama administration people? I saw a woman this morning. I went to the farmer's market here in Arlington, Virginia, and a woman was walked by with a resist T-shirt on, black letters, resist. And, you know, I wanted to stop and say, resist what? I'm sure she'd say resist Trump, resist sexism, resist racism. I don't know what she'd say. But, you know, what I see when I read that, I say resist a Democratic election that didn't go your way. And has it never dawned on these people that two sides could play this game? Would they really want, if their president was elected, all his or her elected officials to be jostled in public, called names on the air by famous people, picketed at their houses, refused service in restaurants?
And also, I mean, the other part of this, and I was just mentioning this to someone, I mean, there is a movement to sort of, you know, in Washington, D.C., and in sort of elite circles, to deny, blacklist these folks, any administration officials, from getting other jobs. They won't let them work in business or law anymore if they come out of the administration.
Yeah. So what's the end game here? What do they hope will happen?
Well, how do we fix it, Carl? Is it just a fever that goes away when Donald Trump is no longer on the scene?
Well, you know, I would think that, except for this, Tom. It was this kind of fever that led to Trump being elected. Remember, these Democrats called Romney a murderer. They ran ads and said Romney had made decisions in private life that had killed a woman. It turned out to all be hokum, of course. The Obama administration, this was for re-election now, the Obama administration associated themselves with those ads. So this has been going on for a while. Remember, George Bush was, before Trump was Hitler, George W. Bush was Hitler. Reagan was a mad bomber. They've talked about this way for a generation, and what happened was independent voters and conservative voters and grassroots voters just tuned them out. So this has been a while coming. I think they're using Trump as an excuse. I think this intolerance of the left is pretty deeply ingrained. And how do we make it go away? People like you and I stand up for civility is one way. And another way is I think they should be punished at the ballot box. I think if this hurts Democrats, if they lose elections because of this, then you'll break the fever. If they win elections because of this, well, this is going to be the new normal. This is the country we'll have devolved into.
A couple minutes left, and I got two. So I'm going to get quick comments on two subjects. One is this Time magazine cover. You know, we follow the media closely and criticism, but so you have this cover of this tiny little girl staring up at Donald Trump, and he's staring down at her. Made huge waves, and then we found out, Carl, that it wasn't true. This girl had, in fact, never been separated from her mother. A huge blunder on the part of Time magazine. They stood by the cover. I think they eventually issued an apology. When the media chooses a symbol for an issue or movement, Carl, like this, and don't bother to check to make sure that that symbol is in fact representative of the problem that they're trying to critique, that is a huge problem for the media and for journalism, is it not?
You know, Tom, that cover, it's, to me, that's an embarrassment, because you make the argument is it could have been another little girl. They're making a different point, a larger point, and the point they're making has some validity to it. It's embarrassing. It's like ABC running on its Chiron last week that Paul Manafort had pleaded guilty to 5 counts of manslaughter. That kind of stuff is indicative of bias, and it's embarrassing. But the real problem is that it's broader than that. We just don't have any norms left in the press. The Washington Post had an editorial. I read it, and I was sort of gobsmacked. They said it was about the border thing and what Trump had said about he couldn't reverse the program. Then he did reverse it. They said, we hesitate to say this. We hesitate to call the president a liar, but he's lying. And I thought, the Washington Post, in allegedly straight news stories, calls the president of the United States a liar every day. They did in that day's paper. Twice on different stories. They've had headlines about it. They always say, this guy's a liar, he's a liar, lie, false. But, and so when we make mistakes on our side, when I say we, the media, it confirms what Trump's been saying about us. And so ultimately this is self-defeating. And these guys, they want to talk about Russia endlessly and how Putin affected our election. Well, what really affected our election was that people turned out the press because they thought the media had taken sides. And every time we confirm that, we help Trump and we hurt the cause of free and open and honest discourse in this country.
Last question real quickly, Carl. We talked about Charles Krauthammer, I think, last week or the week before when the news broke that he only had only a couple of weeks to live. He passed away this week. It was expected, but nevertheless sad. Krauthammer was... I mean, as long as I've been doing this, which is 20 years professionally and knew and read him prior to that, he was one of the greats. And I had the privilege to get to know him and spend a little bit of time with him. And I know you did as well. What a great, great guy. Funny guy, obviously smart, incisive thinker, writer, true intellectual. He will be missed.
Yeah, and do we have time for one brief observation? About
if it's
Charles?
Brief.
Yeah, the last time I saw him was at the Nats game, and he had a place in the handicap section where he season tickets. And I sat down and watched a few innings with him. He said, he pointed to his seat. He said, come by any time. I pay for this seat, and I just keep it open for friends and guests, people I know. So come in any time. And that's the last time I saw Charles, and it's a nice memory of him.
That is a nice memory. And, in fact, they paid tribute to him at the National Stadium.
Yeah.
After his passing. So another great one is gone. Charles Krauthammer, rest in peace. All right, Carl, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much.
All right, Tom.
Okay, that's going to do it for me, Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics. We will see you back here next Sunday night on Chicago's Talk Leader 89 WLS. Have a great week.